Hello there, this is Jonathan Ross introducing another edition of my regular movie podcast, I Like Films. And in this edition, I'll be talking to Rich Moore and Phil Johnson. They're the writer-directors behind the big new Disney movie, Ralph Breaks the Internet. This is, of course, a sequel to Wreck-It Ralph, which was a kind of video game, a love letter to video gaming, which I adored a few years back. So I'm thrilled they came up with a sequel, and even more pleased to be able to say that I've seen it. And I would say it's actually better than the original, which is a rare thing, and we put it right up there with Godfather 2 as one of those films that manages to be better than the source. They have made a number of movies together. They've worked for a long while in animation in their respective fields. They've respectively involved in The Simpsons, Big Hero 6 they were involved with, Zootropolis, which was another movie which I thought was far better than it needed to be. So they promised to be great fun, and we will cover a lot of ground about modern animation and how they do it and why they do it and so on and so forth. Also, shoehorned into this edition is the star of that film, the brilliant John C. Reilly, a terrific actor, of course, a brilliant comic actor, and I think he brings a certain innocence and charm and lovable naivety to this role that few others could. So I hope you enjoy this edition of I Like Films. John, it's lovely to see you again.
Thank you. Good to see you too.
Congratulations on the movie. You know, not that my opinion counts for much, but I preferred it to the first one, even.
Ah, well.
And I loved the first one.
Thank you very much, indeed.
Do you have a preference? Do you ever look at your work in that way?
Well, I tend to look at my work as like children that I've had. You just try to love them all, try to treat them all equally, and don't make the other ones jealous.
Even the ones that didn't turn out quite right.
Well, even the ones that didn't turn out quite right, you end up walking away with some kind of life experience from, you know,
yes,
whether
yes.
It's a new friend or some new place you got to go. But yeah, I do think that the new film is in some ways richer than the first one, because we had to create it from the ground up the first time. We had to create the whole universe and these characters and the relationships, and everything was built for that movie. And when we started this one, we were already that much far ahead.
And I guess
a lot of intimacy to
you have a lot more to play with in a way as well in this film. It isn't just limited to the world of, you know, old gaming.
Yeah. It's funny because these characters are almost like children, how sheltered they are. You know, they live just in this one game and that's pretty much what they know. And they did this adventurous, mischievous thing in the last movie by going into other games. And now this Wi-Fi router has been put in the arcade and they're going off into the wide world. And it's kind of like, you know, like what if 2 8-year-old kids just left their house and went just headed in one direction out into the world? You know, it reminds me of those. Did you hear about those 2 kids in Ireland that managed to fly all the way to New York and they didn't get caught until they were in JFK wandering around? They're trying to steal bracelets to sell them so they have money for food in JFK. And they literally left their house. The mom was like, "Where are you going?" "Oh, we're just going down in the corner."
It's amazing.
They had no money. They snuck their way onto a bus. Then they snuck their way onto a plane. Then they got all the way into America. Yeah. It's an amazing radio story, actually.
It's amazing. And I can see it had a big impression on you.
It did. You should. I think it's The Moth or one of those radio programs. But the guys themselves talk about it. It's pretty funny.
It's interesting you say that, because I was going to ask you about how you play someone like Ralph. Because I was going to say, well, he's kind of like he's a simple character in some ways, with fairly basic needs. But I guess that's the key. He is a child in a way.
Yeah, he's naive, and he and Vanellope don't even know what money is. Somehow they're not even aware of the concept of auctions or money, so they go to eBay in order to get a part for her game. It's interesting, too, the film, because it's the first time that maybe not the first time. I think we did this a little bit in the first movie, but we interact with the real world. We buy something on eBay, and we get it sent to the arcade so her game can survive. But, we go to this arcade, or we go to this eBay auction, and we don't understand. We just think you're supposed to say a larger number. Say a bigger number.
Like winning the game,
whoever says the biggest number wins.
Which is true, of course.
Except then they're like, "You need money. Money? What's that?"
They're kind of, without any of the weird adult sexual side of things, they're Adam and Eve before the fall.
Oh, interesting. Mm. Interesting.
I wouldn't examine that for too long. It doesn't hold up. But they're both charming. And when you're working, do you work with Sarah? Are you guys in a booth together?
Yeah. In a room. You know, it's a really famous soundstage in Burbank, actually, where a lot of the famous cartoons, the voices were recorded in there. So I stand in the same place where Baloo the bear
recorded.
Phil Harris was in there. There's pictures of him around and stuff.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was a really important thing to me going into it, because I'd heard that in animation that the actors often don't even see each other. And I thought, well, that's just a real missed opportunity, because, you know, not only do you get like a soulful quality when you're there with someone and you're saying emotional things or making a connection with them, but if you improvise, you can just do it in real time. Yeah. You don't have to sort of reverse engineer any new ideas that you come up with.
You certainly get that feeling from the film, because there's an energy when they're interacting, which I don't think you could possibly get if you were just staying to a script and you were doing it at different times.
Well, a lot of people successfully create it through artificial means, but I really like that our film has a real beating heart, and that when you watch the film, you know we were actually talking to each other. Not just Sarah, but Jack McBrayer and Alan Tudyk, who
he's amazing.
Plays Nosemore. Yeah, all the characters that I interact with in the film, I was in the studio with.
How much more pleasurable is it, or how kind of like less exciting is it perhaps to be just voicing a character? I mean, obviously it's based on you, but you're not, you know, you don't have to be on screen yourself.
Well, I mean, it's got a lot going for it. It pays pretty well.
Number one, bing. Okay.
And you don't have to change your clothes when you get to work.
Number two.
No one touches your face.
Three.
And you're never racing against time. You're never racing the sun as it's going down, which is the perennial problem of shooting outdoors and live action movies. So you really have this luxury of time, which gives you this amazing kind of fertile environment when you're working together, because no one's ever panicked that you're not going to finish. You're always weeks and weeks, if not months, ahead of the animators. So you just get to try things and want to do it again. Okay. And like, it's just this sort of really free and easy situation. And, you know, for all the mountain of people you see come up in the credits at the end of the movie, for the actors, pretty much it's these five people in the studio. Me and Sarah and Rich and Phil, and maybe a story person from the studio or one of the additional writers. But it's a really intimate, like, fun group. And you just go in this room and try to make each other laugh, or you try to fix problems or come up with ideas. And it's a lot less overwhelming than dealing with 1,000 people or something at once. Although I did go in a couple times to talk with the animators, because, you know, they don't do motion capture at Disney. Animators really look down on that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, it feels like cheating, doesn't it, to them, I think.
But they do, yeah, they're like, we draw, we don't just copy, you know, computer rhythms. But I went in there to do like a movement study with them, and like, they videotaped me moving around, because the character really reminded me of some of my older uncles who used to be football players, you know, with their big guts hanging out and their knuckles up on the bar. So I went in and just goofed around like that, and they filmed me doing it so that, you know, I could help inform the physical vocabulary of the character.
Well, you kind of, I mean, I always thought they must have based the look of him a bit on you, because you do sort of obviously look like him quite a bit.
I guess so now. You know, I actually don't. If you really look at our features, like, they're, I think the reason that Ralph is starting to look like me is because he sounds so much like me, and my facial gestures and expressions are similar to his. Because they do videotape you when you record. So if you raise your eyebrows when you say something, they note that, or they watch it when they're animating, and they use it as reference. But, yeah, it's funny. In the beginning,
I mean, did they have you cast before they started designing him, or were they already working on Ralph and he looked a bit like
that? Well,
they're
working on the idea of a movie about video game characters that whatever. And then there were many different versions of Ralph. There was one that had like my curly hair just popped on him. There was one that was like kind of a horned rhinoceros monster character, you know, because it was just supposed to be a bad guy in a game.
Yeah.
So like Donkey Kong could have been a big gorilla or a monster. It could have been anything. And then as I got involved, what happens is you start to morph into the character. The character starts to morph into you. And the more kind of realistic detail that you're adding with your own facial tics or expressions, that just really it brings the character to life. So
I wish people could see you, because you look superb. You've got a fabulous look. You look like you're channeling old Hollywood. And you know, when you mentioned the voiceover booth and the history and the lineage of like old Disney characters, I get the feeling you are connected. You feel, I mean, obviously you're very much a part of that industry, but do you feel that kind of attachment to it as a place of work, as almost like a spiritual home?
Well, first of all, it's the longest place I've ever worked. I mean, it's the longest job I've ever had at one place. So there is a consistency to that, a feeling like, okay, I mean, I'm a part of this place.
Yeah.
But really, the way you feel connected to the legacy of Disney, because most of the famous people are long gone. You know, Phil Harris is not with us anymore, who played Baloo. But I know that I'm standing in the same place with him. But to answer your question, when you realize that you're part of the Disney legacy is when you meet kids and you realize like, wow, I've gone right into that kid's heart. Mm. You know, it's one thing to move an adult, like you've seen a film of mine or something. Like, yeah, I enjoyed that film. And you see it as a film and you see it as one of many things in your life and some one of many films that you've seen me in or whatever. Little kids, it's a central event in their life. You know, when they're 8 years old and they see Wreck-It Ralph, they haven't seen very many movies yet, first of all. And if you touch them in an emotional way and you really connect with them through the character, that's really meaningful for kids. So that's when you realize like, wow, the way I was touched by The Jungle Book or Pinocchio or Winnie the Pooh or whatever it is, I'm now in that position. And that's when you realize, like, holy cow, this is a really special thing. You know,
it's interesting you say that, because Disney in the 80s, I believe, a friend of mine worked there for a brief period, and they used to get the executives to go out to the parks for a day and dress as the characters to connect with the kids and see what it meant to them. So they could have that kind of visceral moment where they understood, oh, this is what we're meant to be doing, and this is why we're doing it, which is very unusual in cinema, though, because most places, you know, studios come and go, but Disney are not like other places, are they?
Yeah, a lot of places these days I find that people, not only do they not interact with moviegoers, but they don't really go to movie sets or, you know, it's almost like this movie thing is like a business, one part of their business that they need to manage, but they're in the business of making money or something as opposed to like making magic or creating movies. For the most part, it's kind of a... It's an NBA kind of set that's running things now in Hollywood.
Let's talk a little bit about Stan and Ollie, if we can, because I imagine in a way there's a similarity there to an extent. I mean, obviously that's a film which I'm afraid I haven't seen yet. It's not released yet over here, of course, but I'm looking forward to seeing it. You're part of Disney's legacy, and I think, obviously, you're aware of that responsibility, and you're enjoying that connection. But, of course, there's a huge responsibility when you're bringing to life and telling the story of two people who were, for my generation, who grew up in the days before there were many cartoons on TV. In England, we had Laurel and Hardy shorts they used to put on almost every day.
Same here.
And it was just, that was a major thing. And I was in love with them, you know, and so they really meant so much to me. So I guess you have to tread quite carefully.
Well, yes, you have to do your due diligence. And it's funny, Steve and I rehearsed Laurel and Hardy just down the street. When you walk out of this little alleyway where this hotel is, you go to the right, I think it says St. Mary's Church with the neon. We rehearsed upstairs in that church. That's where we learned all our dances and we developed our comedy routines. So I definitely, there's a huge, you know, responsibility there. And as someone who loves Laurel and Hardy, just like you did, they were on TV all the time. There's an interesting reason for that, by the way.
I imagine they were free, were they?
Well, not free, but... Hal Roach, at a certain point, who was the producer of Laurel and Hardy in their heyday, and he also had the Little Rascals and a lot of those 1930s black and white comedy shorts he owned. That was his studio, some early Harold Lloyd. He was approached by the networks when television was invented, and they were like, look, we got 24 hours of airtime every day. We have about 2 hours of content.
What can we fill it with?
Between our news program and our chat show, our variety show, whatever it is. So they needed to fill the airwaves, and Hal Roach sold them his entire catalog, and they just started rolling it over and over. I actually used to drive Stan Laurel crazy because they would often cut for commercial breaks at the wrong moments comedically.
Oh.
They were just kind of chopped into pieces for television. But anyway, and the other downside of that was that Stan and Ollie were salaried employees. They never received any back end or any television residuals of any kind, which is why they ended up having to do these theatrical tours, which is the basis of our movie.
They came to the UK, didn't they?
The last theatrical tour. But as a result of him selling those, his whole library to TV, it created a whole new generation of people that loved them.
Yeah.
You know, if it was just left to, you know, until the 1980s when videotape came out, a lot of people would have just forgotten about them. But they had a whole new generation from TV, then a whole new generation from that videotape era. And now it's never been easier. You can see everything they've ever done.
Well, because they spun off into cartoons back then as well, didn't they? Because of the popularity of the old movies on TV, I think, then one of the companies made a cartoon version of them.
Yeah, that wasn't as big in America, well, but I heard it was...
It wasn't terribly good, but it was quite big. But you know, that's an interesting, because you're talking about legacy. I was thinking recently with the death of Stan Lee, which was a sad event. And I'm a huge Marvel fan, but... And a lot of the creators didn't really get what they deserved from that period. But if they hadn't been owned by Marvel, and they hadn't been kept in print in the way they were, then many of them would have died out. So it's that kind of real double-edged thing.
Yeah. I do wish that Stan and Ollie could have been remunerated better in their life, because they were the authors of those characters. They were the, you know, Stan pretty much directed those films. Yeah. They had directors, but he was really the one calling the shots and coming up with the gags. So, I, you know, that is one thing I wish they were... I wish they had more comfortable lives. They were such beautiful people that gave so much to the world that I wish that they could have been cared for a little better. They both, when they passed away, they both had very, very little money, if any, and they were living in very, very humble circumstances. So, but that just goes to show you they were true artists and true clowns. They didn't really care about business. The reason they didn't have better contracts is because they were too busy having fun and doing the things that they love to do.
And making masterpieces.
Yeah.
What's next for you, John? What are you doing next?
I don't know. I've been promoting movies. I have four coming out between September and January.
Sorry, this, Stan and Ollie. What are the other two?
Earlier this year, Sisters Brothers hasn't come out in the UK yet.
And you've got Holmes and Watson as well.
Yeah, Holmes and Watson, The Sisters Brothers, Stan and Ollie, and Wreck-It Ralph.
But you're massively prolific. I mean, you're a hard-working man.
Yeah,
I mean, you
so
look at
far.
Your. Have you ever looked at your IMDb?
Yeah. Sometimes, when I'm looking, when I'm trying to invite people to things, I'm like, who do I know in this business anyway? And I'll go down, I'll make a screening, like if we're having a screening of a film, I'll go down like, oh yeah, him, he's still alive, yeah that one.
So it's for you, it's like a kind of an address book.
Sort of, or at least jogs your memory of the different periods of your life.
Aid memoir. I was going to ask you about the Beastie Boys video, but we haven't got time. John, it's lovely to see you.
The Beastie Boys book, they just came out with a Beastie book that I did some... I read for the audiobook version of the Beastie Boys book. I read a few of the
stories. Are you a big Beastie Boys fan?
Yeah, they're good friends of mine.
Yeah, they're amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing. John, I hope we get to see a Wreck-It 3. But although he's kind of fixed himself now, so I don't know where you go with him.
Yeah, maybe he just needs to like get all messed up in his head again.
Yeah. <or something>. Lovely to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you.
Start churning butter and put on your church shoes, little sister, because we're about to blast off!
Ralph, what is it you're trying to say?
We're going on the internet.
Okay, so I'm here with Phil and Rich. That's correct.
Yes, sir.
I loved Wreck-It Ralph 2. I think, controversially perhaps, I preferred it to number one, which I adored as well.
Oh, thank you
very much.
But I imagine going in, here you've created something pretty magnificent with the first film. Oh. Going back in the second one, it must have been daunting. And there must have been times when you thought, is this the right thing to do?
Definitely daunting.
Daunting. Once we got into it, I think we both suffer from delusion, you know, that it's almost like guys going on a trip up Everest who think they're going on a hike,
you know,
and we go, wouldn't it be great? We're going to make this movie about the internet. And then the next day realizing we have to design the entire internet.
Because the internet, of course, as you know, doesn't really exist physically.
No,
it turns out it doesn't.
Yeah, yeah. Did you know
that kind of does?
But it kind of does.
Yeah,
you know? It's
in a
these
way.
Huge server farms, these buildings filled with servers, computers, and wires and cables, and it that truly, as crazy as it sounds, that truly inspired the look of the internet world.
I'm going to step away from Ralph for a second and just talk generally about Disney, Pixar, animation in general. Talking to John, You mentioned Phil Harris, Baloo. He was in the same studio with Amazon. Yeah. And you think the legacy of Disney, apart from that, that brief period from about the Rescuers through the perplexing Black Cauldron.
Right. Very strange.
Fox and Hound, not particularly great. Oliver and Company, great Mouse Detective. There was a period where there were a few missteps. And then, boom, back in with Little Mermaid.
Right.
But you think the legacy of that place and working in Disney, it must be quite a... I don't know if it's a pressure or whether it's in itself is just exciting to be there.
It's never too far from your mind. As we walk to our office, you walk past, it's, I think, what do they call it, the Legacy Hall?
Yeah.
And there's artwork from every single film. And so the first thing you see is, oh, there's a hand-drawn image from Snow White. And there's all these Mary Blair illustrations.
Oh, I love it.
All down
Alice
the wall.
Of Wonderland.
And it's like, okay, we're not monkeying around here. We've got to figure this out. So the delusion runs away pretty quickly, and the pressure does mount. Because the legacy is profound, and it's no joke.
And how is it working there? Because I read a little bit about the process here, and it seems to me like it's not workshop exactly, but you throw a lot of ideas around in the early stages of getting this script ready. It isn't traditionally a movie. There's an idea, and then a script writer or a couple will go off and prepare a draft.
Correct.
Yeah.
This seems to be a different way of working.
It is a lot like workshopping. It is kind of like a writer's room where the two of us will come up with an idea, and then we become kind of the shepherds of this idea. Then our little group will grow. We have other writers that work with us, other directors. We'll kind of pitch things. And we're kind of building it as we're making it. Someone described it as you're jumping out of an airplane with the pieces of another airplane, and the job is to put together that airplane before you all hit the ground and die. You know,
I was going to say it's like working with Lego. That's a whole different franchise.
Warner Brothers.
Amazing films, though.
Amazing films.
But I had a PA. All of our meetings, our note sessions, there's someone transcribing the notes, and I had a PA take all of the Word documents and just put them into one document. 30,000 pages of notes we have gotten from the time we started this movie to now. Yeah. So, granted, we don't read them, but but we have been that many words have been
like the Kubrick kind of library. You've got this kind of Wreck-It Ralph library for people. But then I imagine then a lot of ideas and a lot of themes and concepts fell by the wayside. And like all good movies like this, I think there's a fairly straight line as to what the Wreck-It's going through, what Ralph's going through.
Yeah,
right. Correct.
Was that there from day one? Or did that grow out of the process?
I mean, it was always going to be a film about their friendship, the friendship of Ralph and Vanellope, John C. Reilly and Sarah Silverman, and how probably the biggest challenge was knowing that the friendship had to have a rift. We knew that they had become friends in the first film, and this was going to be a movie about testing it. And how could Ralph's insecurity and self-doubt become the actual villain in this film? And that did not come early or without a lot of pain.
But that was the notion.
Yeah. So the moment you got that, though, is there a moment where you say, oh, we have got it now? Or is that still a process of, okay, that might work?
Like about a week ago, I think. We
watching the finished product. It's not, oh, that will work. It's like, I think that's going to work. I think you get this kind of feeling that, I think we've arrived. I think we've kind of solved this one.
And it hit us both.
Yeah.
I remember the day, it was last spring, so maybe 6 months ago, we're like, all right, I think we've cracked it. I actually like this movie again. Yeah. I love these characters and where we're putting
it. It was on the pretty same exact late day that we looked at each other and said, like this movie.
And of course, you know, it occurred to me afterwards, without wishing to be too spoilery, but you know, he breaks the internet, but by doing that he then fixes himself, of course. So you've got that beautiful, it just sort of the flow works perfectly for it. But of course you wind up in a position now where really, unless something traumatic happens to him, there's not going to be another Wreck-It Ralph movie.
That's exactly the same. Yeah. I mean, we didn't think there was going to be a second one until we started kind of picking at the end of the first movie, in which it ended with the line, if that kid likes me, how bad can I be? And we thought, that is a beautiful sentiment. What a grace note to go out on. How do you improve on that? We thought, well, that is actually a very, very dysfunctional way to live, you know, because he's defining himself by his best friend.
Like as what RuPaul says, if you don't love yourself, how the hell is anyone else going to?
Exactly.
I think that's what RuPaul says.
I think it's... It sounded like it should. RuPaul.
Are you big RuPaul fans, by the way?
Yeah, who isn't?
Who doesn't love the drag race?
I mean, come on.
Quotes like that, how can you not be?
Were you guys initially, were you always wanted to work in animation? Were you just fans of animation generally, or were you just wanted to make movies and wound up in animation?
Well, I myself always wanted to work in animation.
Were you an artist as well?
Yes. My mom was an artist, so she always encouraged creativity in our house. And I, at 5 years old, the first movie I saw in a movie theater was The Jungle Book. And I was, it just put its hooks in me.
Which was kind of, it was the last that Walt himself ever saw, I think. Mm-hmm.
It was the last 67. One that he was in, 67 it came out. Right. I was, four or five when I saw that movie. And I didn't know how it was made. I didn't know if those were drawings or people in costumes or...
You were quite a simple child.
Yes, I was very dumb.
Oh, there is something really wrong.
You know, I thought those were costumes.
I mean, let's say an uncomplicated child. Yeah. That's a nice way of putting it.
Well, I'm an American, so from that moment on, that became my true north, I wanted to work in that world.
With that idea, that dream, that ambition.
And I even went to college to get a degree in animation. There is such thing. I went to CalArts in Valencia, in California. This is just the continuation of a dream that I had as a child.
The other greats as well, like Max Fleischer Studios, Oob Iwerks.
Oob, yep, good old Oob
Iwerks. My kids, I used to, in the early days of Laserdisc, I had an Oob Iwerks box set. We flipped the fog.
Right.
And my children watched that more than Disney. And when we went to Disney World once, they went, can't we go to Iwerks World? And in an ideal universe, there would be a flip the fog wandering around in there somewhere as well. And what about you? Were you also headed in that direction?
No. My path is much weirder, or maybe not weirder, but much different in that I, out of undergraduate in college, became a journalist. I'd always loved film and went to the movies all the time. But I didn't have the nerve, I don't think, when I was 18 to pursue the dream. So I worked it for 10 years as a broadcast journalist all over the States and Minneapolis and different markets like that.
And was that because to say it out, you didn't realize you wanted to do it? Or would it be to say it out loud would have felt like you were opening yourself up to either criticism or people not believing you could?
I think it didn't occur to me that this was a thing a kid from a small town in the Midwest could do. I thought it was... I don't think I had the, not to say imagination, but the nerve, the courage to say, why don't you go pursue this? Not that journalism is easy by any means, but
it's more accessible.
There's more of a path. There's more of a, you go to film school.
I think that's a common misconception in our business that, well, you can't make a living doing this. Yeah. You know, you can't, nobody does that stuff anymore.
Yeah.
How are you going to live? What are you going to live
on? Well, thankfully, of course, now we're kind of in a golden age for this because you've got a wider appreciation in the West of Japanese and Korean animation.
Absolutely.
You've got a kind of more of a marketplace on television with all the new channels and the new platforms. And, of course, you've got, not just Disney and Pixar, the mighty titans there, but you've also got, as you said, Warner's are doing it, Fox are doing it, everyone's...
Oh, yeah.
With mixed results, but it is a boom period, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And we have a great... storyboard artist Natalie Nurigut, who learned animation online. Like, she didn't go to school for it. She eventually did go to college to study it, but like, she's an amazing artist and is largely self-taught.
And she learned via the internet, which brings us back to the problems that must have faced you, because everything is there.
Yeah.
And I know that you've been asked by a few European journalists as to why some things that we find on the internet, whether we want to or not, weren't included. I'm amazed that people are asking you. Here's a family film.
Yes.
A classic family film. It's coming from Disney, and people are asking you why you didn't refer to porn, internet porn.
It's like asking Pete Doctor in Inside Out. Well, it's all taking place in the brain. Why didn't you examine schizophrenia or Alzheimer's?
Yeah.
You know, or inoperable tumors?
But kind of those you could... tumors, maybe not. Yeah. But certainly you could hint at those.
That is true.
There's no way you could put pornography in this film.
You probably weren't going to be successful if you made that reference in this film.
Yeah.
There are lots of things, lines we cross and then are pulled back. That's one it didn't even occur to us to cross that line.
Why would it?
I don't know.
Although you send them down into the dark web,
which
isn't, it's nowhere near as bad as I thought it would be.
It's a wonderful place.
I hear it's the happiest place on earth.
Yeah. It is second happiest.
Yeah. So obviously you're kind of like not Disneyfying, but sanitizing to an extent, while still referring to some of the things which adults will pick up on, which kids won't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a guy selling mother's maiden names and social security numbers and that sort of thing. But to me, beyond that scene in the dark web where Ralph goes to procure a virus, the sort of more insidious thing about the film is the scene in the comments room where Ralph goes and is trolled, which I think is something that's more relatable to kids and, frankly, anybody, simply because there's so much anonymous venom that gets spewed online at times. So it is this wonderful place where you can learn animation or take a class at MIT, but there's also a lot of nasty, vile stuff in there.
Yeah, it was lovely. I mean, it was very funny, the whole kind of like getting likes and the kind of obsession that people have with getting likes and the casual way with which we interact with it and the way we see people, you know, slumped and bored at work and just looking for some stimulus and they find it with someone smacking themselves in the face. Yeah. Which, of course, we do. I mean, I'm sure you have wasted many a morning like I have, looking on Facebook, perhaps, and just seeing people falling over. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, God, human suffering is endlessly hilarious.
I have an endless appetite for people falling off things. I never knew until now.
I know.
Who knew?
Who knew?
I guess it was more of a kind of a business problem than it was for you. But when you're reflecting aspects of the real world, like eBay features prominently in it as well, I think Instagram is kind of hinted at. Pinterest is referred to in a very funny moment.
Yes.
I love that. But there's lots of references to... You don't go to YouTube, though, I notice, as such. You call it something else. Now, was there a reason for that?
Well, because we call it BuzzTube, you know, and it's this video sharing site where Ralph's videos begin to go viral. And the reason that we did that was because we wanted the currency of BuzzTube to be these hearts, you know, to... The symbol of the heart of in Ralph.
So that's more of an Instagram kind of addictive problem.
You know, so we said, and YouTube is more like a thumbs up, you know, so why don't we create our own?
Because the heart's tied to the heart.
He wears it as a medal. And just the love that he has for his friend. So that one became...
It wasn't them saying no, and it wasn't you having any beef with YouTube. It was an artistic choice.
It was a creative choice.
And YouTube exists, like, in the cityscape. They drive past YouTube. Yeah. And the reason we went to eBay was because it was the best... we couldn't come up with a better online auction site than that. And we wanted to do kind of like we did in the first movie, where you had Pac-Man and Street Fighter and Q-Bert and stuff alongside games we had made up. So we wanted to include all of those brands to feel like the real internet integrated with the stuff we made up.
Yeah. Now, what's the racing game called? Slaughter
Race.
Now, I would obviously like to play that now.
Who wouldn't?
Is that happening? Are they going to do that?
Oh, man.
I mean, I'm surprised if they aren't. Someone somewhere isn't thinking, especially with Gal Gadot's voice in it.
That would be great.
Yeah. She's amazing, by the way. She's amazing.
She was wonderful to work with. She plays a character from the Slaughter Race game,
which is kind of, I'm going to say this so you don't have to, it's like a mashup of like a hardcore racing game with GTA.
Right.
Yeah.
And then it's movies like Fast and the Furious and, you know, all kind of mixed into this more mature game than Vanellope Sugar Rush, where she comes from. And Gal was fantastic.
Yeah, amazing in that.
And she sings.
And she,
is that her singing?
That's her singing. There's a moment where
I'm going off. I don't like it when people are too good at too many things.
She's
kind of frustrating.
Too good for this earth.
Now this is it's computer generated animation,
correct?
But not motion capture. I know that's kind of looked down on a little bit by traditional animators, isn't it?
That's true. We never use motion capture, you know, as a basis for performances. Even though we don't do the traditional hand drawn, we approach the animation performances the same way that Walt did in the old days. We always take video of our actors as they're recording, but it's more for just referring to, like, what did Sarah Silverman's mouth look like when she actually said that word?
I guess the challenge in animation is because the budgetary constraints aren't the same. You can be anywhere. You can do anything for virtually the same cost as two people sitting in a room, unlike, you know, live action. So if there's no limits, is that in its own way sort of harder?
In some ways it is, I think. I mean, this internet world is, they tell us, the biggest ever that's been created in an animated film. And the number of characters, we have over 1 million Ralphs at one point.
I love that. Yeah, that was masterfully done. I thought, do you animate all them individually, or is there a program where you can kind of like replicate and have just slightly different movements?
Well, there's several different cycles that are worked out for them, quite a few, and then the computer assigns them to all those different little figures. It would take forever to actually.
It's like when you do hair. There's a kind of program
that simulates the movement.
But I felt you were cheating. I looked at there were 4,000 Ralphs on screen, and that one over guy, there, he repeated that movement twice.
Yeah, he looks a little bit
I want my money back.
But that does make it daunting, because it's sort of the imagination is where, you know, that's your only limit at this point, technologically speaking. And so coming up with a simple story, this simple story of these two buddies who have a falling out and a toxic moment of their friendship, like, that was frankly the part that was harder in some ways than figuring out the grand scope of the world.
But that doesn't surprise me in a way, because what's the appeal of the film at the end? Why will people like it? Because it has a heart.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't have a heart, and if it doesn't have a kind of recognizable human conflict and resolution, then it doesn't matter how great it looks.
Yeah. The audience.
I mean, I'll point you to Treasure Planet.
Yeah.
I'll point you to Treasure Planet. I'll point you to Atlantis. Yeah. There's a number of Disney movies which looked great and have fabulous moments in, but didn't connect with the audience because the story was too complicated or not clear enough.
If the audience cannot recognize themselves in the characters, if you don't care about the characters, all the icing on the cake means nothing.
There was a sweet moment, and I'm guessing this wasn't added because obviously it's very recent, but briefly, we see Stan Lee in the film.
Correct.
As well, of course. And that must be something you added already. And although it's terrible that we've sadly just lost him, 95, not a bad age, of course, but lovely to see him on screen there.
So cool. Yeah.
Now, is that part of the Marvel-Disney synergy? It's like, well, we have him as cameos in the comic book movies. Why don't we have him a cameo here?
We have a section at a website called Oh My Disney. It's all Disney thing, not just animation, but Marvel, Star Wars, Muppets.
A fabulous sequence.
And we said, well, in the Marvel section, we need to have a cameo by Stan Lee. You know, so we designed a little character of himself and had him in there, and it's even more poignant. Now,
I love the princesses sequence as well. I imagine that's hitting big with people. And of course, you're lucky you're making this move now, because 20 years ago, it would have been a largely white cast, of course. But now you can reflect the diversity that we all demand in our films, quite rightly. But you play off the characters beautifully. Now, I'm imagining there must be a number of flags that go up that you have to kind of get past when you're dealing with such well-loved characters, like Snow White, for example.
Those princesses are sort of the foundation of the studio, along with Mickey Mouse. And so when the idea came up, we did some storyboards and cut together an animatic and showed it to the other writers and directors at the studio. They loved it. We're like, all right, this might work.
Time to run it up better. The flesh.
So who runs Disney now? I don't know who runs Disney now. Who's the top dog at Disney?
That would be Bob Iger.
Bob Iger's at the top. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have to run it past Bob?
Yeah.
So we take
it
to
all
Bob.
The way up to Bob.
Yep. So we take
this
it to
particular
Bob.
Scene
and you
did.
Personally go into Bob?
We go to Bob.
So you go and sit in Bob's office. So you're like the Coen brothers sitting outside.
Yes.
in the film The Player.
So Bob, we got a real humdinger for you here.
And Bob goes, and who are you guys?
What do you got for me?
Are you Disney?
You got 5 minutes, kids.
Okay,
pitch away.
And do you have to pitch it? Is it a pitch?
No, we want to show you the
sequence. And he laughed and he goes, this is hilarious. It's like people have had fun making fun of us, you know, for years. Why shouldn't we?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. But that's what gives it a kind of a humanity and a kind of a contemporary feel as well, of course.
That's the thing. Yeah. Like, it's when you satirize your family, you can do it, and you can do it with love, and it's funny, but if someone else pokes fun at them with venom or malice, it's not as funny because there's not love behind it.
Hi.
whoa, ladies, I'm a princess too.
What kind of a princess are you?
Do you have magic hair?
No.
Magic hands?
No.
Do animals talk to you?
No.
Were you poisoned?
No.
Cursed?
No.
Kidnapped or enslaved?
No. Are you guys okay? Should I call the police?
Do people assume all your problems got solved because a big, strong man showed up?
Yes! What is up with that?
She is a princess!
that scene to us is not just a set piece deconstructing the princesses. You know, it leads to Vanellope singing this crazy want song.
And you got Menken to write.
Alan Menken wrote a song.
That's amazing. You got Menken to do it.
Yes.
And we even said, like, this song, it needs to be, it's got to be like an Alan Menken type song.
Yeah.
Who can we get in our vice?
Well, you could have got the South Park guys because they did a pretty good Menken song in their
true.
Movie.
That's true.
That was as good a Menken song as you get without him involved.
That was really banging on the door.
But we wanted genuine heart. Like, as funny as it is and silly as it is, the sort of the juxtaposition of a real Menken song.
Well, it's silly, and you get a lovely moment of laughter when you realize, oh, this is her moment.
Yes.
And then you are transported by the song, so you pull it off beautifully, I think.
Thank you.
A really lovely job.
I'm really proud of that.
So what are you doing next? Are you staying in animation? Because at the moment, it seems that if you have a successful animation movie, 5 years down the line, Disney's going to want to make a live-action version of it anyway.
Right, that's true. Yeah.
So, I mean...
Why don't we just make the live-action
Wreck-It Ralph?
I know, you've got to give it... It's got to be 5 more years, I think, before you go back to it. It's got to be long enough
I have the best idea.
Yeah?
Rich hates it.
I just don't understand.
Is this a genuine idea you have?
I mean, it kind of is, because you're mentioning live-action. I had this idea that Ralph goes into a 3D printer and gets 3D printed into the real world. It could be live action. And stop asking what material is printing. It doesn't matter.
Look, hopefully by the time you finish it, it'll be slightly better than...
That's true.
It won't take 17 hours to make a figure that is an inch tall.
That's to make a doorstop.
It's the biggest disappointment of my life, 3D printers.
I was so looking forward to it.
I was so excited about it. And then what? 17 hours to get something I don't want.
A bobble.
Let's be honest, a piece of shit.
A piece of shit can be a bobble. Yeah,
that's true. That's true. Well, that was one idea.
That's what kills the movie for me already.
Yeah.
I'm not going to see a 3D printing movie. Although 3D printing in 3D.
All right, there it is.
That's pretty good. Or 4D. But it's going to be 17 hours long.
But genuinely, what's next for you guys?
Well, I think a long vacation. I really don't know.
How long did it take to make this, by the way? How much?
3.5 years all counted. But we've been going since Zootopia.
But that's longer than making a live action movie, even with development.
It's a longer process. And I think the rigor of the process is part of why a lot of these animated films are operating on a higher level than other films, because they are beaten up so thoroughly by really smart people, and the movie becomes the thing that has the ego, and because we, you know...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's weird, isn't it? Because it's a bit like TV seems to be the writer's medium,
mm-hmm,
and live-action film seems to be the director's medium. And obviously, you couldn't make an animated movie without directors, but it isn't purely the director's medium, is it, animated film?
Having worked in both, I think that's a fair assessment.
The notion of an auteur in animation is, I think... misleading because we had 500 people working on this film. Yeah. So,
and now I'm going to ask you to name all of them.
Yes.
Okay, starting with the A.
There are 240 Garys on this movie.
I thought I'm going to stay and watch the credits because I know you're going to have something buried away. And of course there is, and that's traditionally is what you have now in the Disney Marvel movies. We know that's going to happen.
Yes.
So you don't need. Mm-hmm. Here you don't know. So there's a big risk that a lot of people won't see what is a very joyful moment tucked away mid-credits.
It's worth the wait.
Yeah, it is worth the wait. But a lot of people want to see it.
Yeah, no, it's true.
They should take the risk.
Because there are 600 or 700 people listed in the credits, so it takes a long time. But
it's pretty good music to listen to, though.
There's good music. And
No, it's...
And I met Rick Astley last night.
Mm-hmm. You're giving it all.
You know, they say,
no, I'm not.
They say never meet your heroes. How was it for you?
Oh, my God.
Honestly, a hero.
He's the loveliest guy.
He's so nice.
Yeah.
His music helped me.
Because you have him, because of course the Wickwalling is a big internet phenomenon.
Yeah, he's such a good sport. Yeah. And he's so talented, and he performed a little bit last night. And it's just like, oh my God, this is what a moment.
That's it. Well, if you only got that out of this experience, presumably it would have been worthwhile.
Without question.
Absolutely. Okay. It was all worthwhile.
Not going for Disney here, but what's your favorite animated movie from elsewhere?
From elsewhere. Well,
I know it's going to be Studio Ghibli.
I will have to say, and not just because he's a good friend, but Brad Bird's Iron Giant.
Iron Giant was so underrated. Didn't do that well. Amazing film.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, I just watched it again recently. It's as good as when I saw it the first time.
But of course, because he did the Incredibles, didn't he?
Yes, correct.
Yeah, so he's doing okay.
Yeah.
He's not amazing. Bad, this Brad Bird guy.
But that was kind of different because it felt a little bit more young adult.
It did. It was not for children.
But that's a struggle in America, making a cartoon, an animated feature, which slightly older kids,
yeah,
you know, dealing
especially
with those
movies.
Stories.
Well,
yeah.
One of my favorites, speaking of, is Anomalisa, which Charlie Kaufman saved from a few years ago,
that's
which was purely adult, and I loved every second of it.
Yeah.
I just, you know, coming from a more independent film background, I completely appreciated that film
Fantastic
and thought,
Mr. Fox.
Yeah,
a good
also
one.
Really
you
good.
You know, I didn't like Fantastic Mr. Fox at all.
I loved it.
It annoyed me. Matter of fact, you've made me quite angry even mentioning
I'm
it.
I'm sorry.
I'll be honest with you.
I'm sorry. Should I leave?
We were having a lovely time together.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Had
he,
to
does
mention
this.
Mr.
he does
Fox.
This. You cannot take him anywhere.
The, I'll just go to the foyer.
I'm fuming.
Sorry. You know what I hate? Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah. No, I didn't mind it. I didn't like. Did you like Isle of Dogs, though?
I did not.
No. Yeah, I didn't either. Isn't that weird? It's like it's
you guys,
so,
you're ganging up on me.
Well, obviously we're more kind of, should we say cerebral?
I think we are.
I mean, I go from the gut, guys.
Is sophisticated the word I'm looking for?
Yeah,
I
think it's,
I'm a little more. Yeah, I'm.
We've established he was a simple child.
simple American child that has horrible taste in animated films.
It's endearing. It is.
You love him like you love a dog that comes and pees on the rug, but you still love the dog.
Wreck-It Ralph and Shank right here. And you presumably you were gamers, or you are gamers, or did you approach it as just a very strong idea when you first came up with it?
I have gained.
Okay, you so know. You weren't a gamer then, and you now you
no,
still are.
No, he I, was, I was, and oh, is, and am not.
Okay. Favorite game at the moment?
Right now, Red Dead Redemption 2.
Yeah, I found it really slow. I'm still stuck at the
oh
beginning.
Oh, my gosh, you don't like anything?
I'm too slow. No, I'm going to like it, I'm sure.
Oh, okay. But
well, there are several intellectual trivia games
oh,
I play.
Please.
And
Tetris.
Tetris. No, I'm an old time arcade gamer, which was my love of the first film. How we became buddies was based on the mutual love of arcade games.
So I'm going to ask you a general question about gaming: is why does it seem to be so hard to take a successful game and then make it into a successful film? Do you think
that's a great question?
Well, because
why?
I think it's because they are not built to have a three-act structure.
They're not built to have any structure, are they?
None. They're just supposed to be open-ended, you know.
But
so
even so,
I guess,
with a character.
Exactly.
It's true. I mean, because I think maybe the characters are so accepted by a wide group of people and you imbue what you think that character is
about. Yeah, I suppose, because if you look at Lego, you know, we love those Lego movies.
Yeah.
And that's because there is nothing that you can take from the bricks that you need to put in the film.
Correct.
So they did have a kind of, apart
Correct.
From the bricks themselves and the look of the world, whereas you go with Lara Croft, say, there are elements that Lara Croft fans need to see in the film.
Right.
And then as a filmmaker, I guess you're tied to them.
Yeah.
It's like adapting a great novel, which sometimes works, often doesn't. I've been working for years on Confederacy of Dunces, and it never gets made because everyone wants that character to be that story exactly the way that
John C would make a great lead.
Ignatius
Riley, yeah, he'd make a great Ignatius.
I think because with the games, it's you spend a lot of time with it and you're imbuing so much of yourself into the avatar that the character will never live up to your expectations.
But do you, I
thank
mean,
you.
Do you think
not
cinema,
so simple now, huh?
But do you know now you've surprised us with your complexity. But do you think cinema will evolve? Because we keep getting, I mean, you know, filmmakers dabble with virtual reality. And of course, it's very hard for a filmmaker to, because they can't guide the sight of the
audience. I mean,
the audience.
It eliminates the camera.
Yeah, but having said that, there's something in there. There's surely something in there as a form of entertainment, which maybe would be suited to that.
I think so. I think we are yet to crack the language of a virtual reality story. The same way when film started, how do we use this camera? Where do we point it? And,
but that's an exciting thing, I thought. I remember Douglas Trumbull invested and developed something called ShowScan. I don't know if you know it, which they shot at twice the speed of regular film going through the camera.
So
and it was
cool.
70 mil or more. It was about 140 mil, I think.
It was, I think, 70 mil one. I saw it.
I think they did a bigger film going through one stage, and they had to damp down the sound. But they had to rethink the grammar, because if they shot it in a conventional way, it was too in the audience's face.
Yeah.
So
it's
quite an exciting challenge.
And what worked well with that is like when you're behind the wheel of a car or something, when it's just kind of in the environment, it's the storytelling aspect that's always, you know, the hardest
to
crack.
We saw this thing, it was at LACMA in LA, and it's probably traveling, that Iñárritu did, called Carne y Arena, which was a VR experience about these migrants that were traveling through Mexico. And it was one of the most profound experiences I've had, certainly the most profound in VR. And
it was that 360 VR.
You take your shoes off, you're walking through the desert, you're walking on gravel.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's wonderful.
How you do that with a mass audience is its own question.
That's not one to take the kids to see, though, is it?
No, it's
hey, kids.
Yeah.
Guess what we're going to see?
We're going to walk on gravel.
But I would.
You're going to walk 100 miles an hour. But a powerful idea, brilliant idea
really
to take
good.
That and use it for that message.
Yeah. We're right at the cusp.
It feels like that's something I would love to toy around with in the future. But how you tell the story, a complete narrative that way, is a challenge.
So are you guys locked into the House of Mouse now? Are you kind of Disney? Are you Disney till you die? Are you committed to do the next movie with them? Or are you currently free agents and open to offers?
Well, you got an idea?
No, I just, well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, yeah. I mean, I'd like to finally do that Red Dead movie.
Yeah. This time we're going to get it
slow
right.
Beginning.
Red Dead Ross.
Yeah.
Because I guess this
we're
is
part of the family.
Already a hit, I believe, in America. It's done fantastically well with this Thanksgiving weekend. And then,
yeah. I mean, we're both, as directors, employees of Disney. My thing about whatever movie I work on next is, what is the idea? And if... Like, Rich has worked exclusively in animation, and I've done
it's
some
simple.
So I've done some live action.
Have
so,
stirrings to go back to live action.
Well, no, if there's an idea that takes place in a hotel room, there's not a compelling reason necessarily to make that an animated film. You know, it's been said before, but it's a medium, not a genre, and it depends on the idea.
Disney kind of is a genre, isn't it? Disney is sort of a genre.
Well, what I like about what we've been doing, Zootropolis, Wreck-It Ralph. Is that we're kind of breaking, you know, that genre. It's like you can't really say,
Zootropolis
well, this
was much
like
more
this.
Sophisticated than I expected it to be. You know, and I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for that.
I mean,
Thank you. In a way,
Zootropolis was the movie I wanted Roger Rabbit to be.
Right? Well, that's
you don't have to say that. You can't say that, in fact, but I can say that. We'll take you out saying, yes, you're right.
Yes, right.
But we're trying to keep with the core of what a Disney movie is, which is the emotion you're talking
about.
Right.
Which
I would want to do whether I was working at Warner Brothers or Universal or anywhere. That philosophy that Walt sort of created, or at least championed.
Fostered, certainly, and guarded.
Yeah, I think much. Is, to me as a filmmaker, no matter what I'm doing, I would hope would always be there.
That's the core of the story.
So,
yeah.
And we push the limits in terms of tone and some of the comedy, because we both love comedy so much. And, Rich worked on The Simpsons for all those years and Futurama. So clearly coming from a place that's left of center from what Disney typically
is
thought of.
It's not family. It's not necessarily the kind of family animation.
Yeah.
Older.
On the older perimeter.
Yeah. Isn't that weird that on TV, that's what people want in their animation?
It's amazing.
Whereas in cinema, that's what turns people off.
It's pretty amazing.
Apart from the South Park movie, if we go back to that.
But then that
was kind of a brand name. And,
right.
Yeah.
They knew what they were getting into.
But do you ever feel frustrated when you see a film? I don't know if you saw it. Did you see Your Name? The Japanese.
I have not seen it yet.
Amazing film. Quite in a way, kind of a teen movie, but very complex, which you wouldn't be able to get made for a Western studio.
It would be much harder. I don't know how you would do that. You know,
but you could say it would be hard, other than there are talking animals in Zootropolis, hard to make a kids movie about racism, and with a noir storyline.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That on its surface. Is not an easy sell.
But I guess that wasn't how you pitched it. You didn't go in and say,
no.
We want to make a Disney film about racism. Right. Bob Iger would not
listen
let you
to
sit
this.
In those chairs.
Here we go. Here's what we got for you, Bob. Racism.
Racism, yes.
Next.
Yeah.
Out. Mickey Mouse is a racist. That's our pitch for you. Yeah, maybe not.
There's the pull cord.
Yeah. Although, I
but
can't see that.
It would be hard, though, to make something like Your Name, you know, in America. But I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah, and that's not in any way a criticism of the American state of animation in America, which I think, as I said, it's a kind of a golden age in a way.
It is, you know, but there is a stigma to what kinds of stories you can tell.
And would the two of you, or individually, would you like to work in the more traditional two-dimensional cell animation? Because there's something about that. There is something magical about that, which I don't think we miss in the modern films.
Mm-hmm.
But you do interact with it in a different way, don't you?
Well, definitely. I mean, I was trained in that medium. And kind of to what you're saying about live action to animation, if there were a story that screamed for this needs to be traditional 2D cell animation, I would jump at it in a moment.
Our friend Lauren McMullen, who is a story artist on First Ralph and this one, did this amazing short, Mickey Gets a Horse. Is that what
it's called? Get a Horse.
Get a Horse. Yeah. That was 2D and then turned into CG. Yeah. And it was the coolest, I mean, I think it was Oscar nominated, so yeah. I guess people know about it. But that idea of sort of like the Roger Rabbit thing, but mm-hmm. 2D into CG, was so well executed and is such a cool idea. But it's very specific to that.
So it needs to be that medium.
Yeah. Did you see the weird, I don't know if it was Disney or Pixar, I know they're kind of the same, but they're not. Yeah. That weird one about the dumpling and the mummy.
Yes, yeah, that's a Pixar. What's that? Really funny.
I mean, that came out last
year. Yeah, it did.
It was very funky.
Crazy but still, wonderful.
By the end, it was like, I love this.
Yeah, you know, I don't think she pitched that by saying, a mother eats her child.
No.
Bob?
We got one about cannibalism here.
Are you still there, Bob?
Yeah. Hey, where are you throwing me? Out the window?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. So genuine, I thought it was better than the first one. I loved the first one because being a gamer as well, especially an older man who's gamed. So I grew up with 8-bit.
Yeah.
So to see 8-bit references was a joy. But to see you do that with the internet and to take it into that realm and to see how playful you did, because I pride myself on sort of being able to second guess people all the time, and it's an annoying habit, I know. But I couldn't. I couldn't have predicted what you were going to do with this, and it was just delightful. So congratulations.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see more from the two of you.
Thank you very much.
Great talking to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, since he is Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah, but break the internet, it's like a thing.
Right, it's just wreck the internet kind of sounds better, doesn't it?
You're not wrong.
I enjoyed that. I hope you did too. Thank you to Rich Moore and Phil Johnson and, of course, John C. Reilly for giving me their time. Next week's edition of I Like Films will be me talking to Ben Wheatley, the brilliant and rising British film director who had High Rise out about a year ago, before that A Field in England, Sightseers, which was incredible, and probably my favourite of his movies, actually, Kill List, a really early one. He also did a few episodes of Doctor Who, has done a lot of TV, and is about to do, it's just been announced, the new movie version of Rebecca, which, in the interest of full disclosure, I should say, is based on a script that was written by my wife, although I suspect they'll change it and probably mess it up, and I'll have a lot of grief at home when she knows I've been talking to Ben and saying good things about him. I hope you can download that one. Remember to subscribe if you haven't already. This is Jonathan Ross saying goodbye.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar Sampler Pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.